I'm Richard Brendan. On today's episode, I have John Shelby Spong, whose books have sold more than 1 million copies. He was Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Newark for 24 years before his retirement in 2001. His admirers acclaim him as a teaching bishop who makes contemporary theology accessible to the ordinary layperson. He's considered the champion on an exclusive faith by many, both inside and outside the Christian Church. In one of his recent books, The Sins of Scripture, Exposing the Bible's Texts of Hate to Discover the God of Love, this visionary leader seeks to introduce readers to a proper way, actually, to engage the holy book of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Spong has been a strong proponent of feminism, gay rights, and equality within both the church and society at large. Towards these ends, he calls for a new Reformation in which many of Christianity's basic doctrines could be formulated. A visiting lecturer at Harvard and at universities and churches worldwide, Bishop Spong delivers more than 200 public lectures each year to standing-room-only crowds. His best-selling books include Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalism, A New Christianity for a New World, Here I Stand, and Jesus for the Non-Religious. He's done 60 Minutes, Today Show, Good Morning America, Fox News Live, Bill Maher, Bishop Spong and his wife Christine. They have 5 children and 6 amazing grandchildren. They live in New Jersey, and it's from his home in New Jersey that he joins us today. Bishop Spong, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Richard. Good to be with you.
It strikes me that last time I had you on, I had contacted your publicist, and you and your wife were in Europe. This time I contacted you, and you were all in Europe again, teaching various locations.
Yes, we just returned from about 30 days in Germany, Scotland, England, and Wales. It was great fun.
That's wonderful. You must have been excited. There's some news fairly recently about the marriage equality law in New York.
Yes, I am. I'm very pleased. I think the time has come for that, and also it looked to me like a pretty skillful political operation over there.
I think that's what I was most impressed with when you understood, you know, the governor and his background, but also the other leadership he had to work with.
Yep.
There clearly was a lot of creative navigating going on.
Yeah, well, it's amazing. There is an art of politics. It's not all evil. Good leadership means that you understand where the pockets of opposition are, and you address them directly, and you treat them with respect. And it was rather amazing because it passed a Republican Senate.
Yes, that was amazing. One of your books that you wrote not too long ago, Jesus for the Non-Religious, you wrote in the preface that throughout your professional life, you followed the motto of your theological seminary, and that was, seek the truth, come whence it may, and cost what it will.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, because of the 4 decades of being a powerful voice for progressives, what's been the cost so far?
Well, it's been interesting. I think it's really minor when you think about the accomplishments that we've been able to make as a church. When I was a young member of the Episcopal Church, I lived in North Carolina, and our church was radically segregated. And I was even taught in Sunday school that segregation was the will of God, and the Bible was quoted to prove that. I was also taught that women were not, by their very creation, equal to men, and the Bible was quoted to prove that. And I was taught that it was okay to hate other religions, and especially the Jews, and the Bible was quoted to prove that. And I was taught that homosexuals were either mentally sick or morally depraved, so they ought to be either cured or converted, and the Bible was quoted to prove that. We've come a long way from that. The Bishop of North Carolina in the Episcopal Church today is an African-American of enormous talent named Michael Curry.
Hmm.
The presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church is a very gifted woman named Catherine Jeffrey Shorey. The last time we did a prayer book, revised our prayer book, we had a panel of rabbis go over it to make sure there was no hidden or latent anti-Semitism in it. And we now have 2 openly gay bishops who live in public relationships with their partners. And when I retired, I had 35 out of the closet gay and lesbian clergy serving openly in this diocese. And that's just an enormous amount of progress for a lifetime. So I think we have made progress. Now, does that mean everybody's been happy? Oh, no, we've had disaffections, but you always have disaffections.
Mm-hmm.
We could not have desegregated the Christian church without losing people who were deeply racist. Now, they didn't know they were racist. They were not evil people. That's the way they were grow. That's the way they were raised. I was raised that way. I know the price of that. I know what it means to be attacked by the Ku Klux Klan. I had plenty of experience with that when I lived in Eastern North Carolina. I've had 16 death threats, almost all of them related to the work I've done for gay and lesbian equality. And all of them came from Bible-quoting true believers. That is, nobody, no atheist ever threatened my life. No Buddhist ever threatened my life. So that, you know, there's a cost to leadership, but there's also a cost not to be a leader, because I think something in you dies if you go against what you know is right. And, you know, that's look at Martin Luther King. Look at Jesus. You know, they helped. They both paid a price for breaking the mold of the religious rut of their day and challenging the status quo. I think that goes with the territory.
Mm. What's at the root of many of the interpretations to justify some of the bigotry and hatred over the years that you've been talking about?
Well, the problem with it is that the Bible was written somewhere between 1,000 years before the birth of Jesus and 135 years after the birth of Jesus. And so it reflects the cultural point of view. Women were looked upon as second-class citizens in that period of history. You can't have polygamy, which you have in great sections of the Bible, if you don't treat women as property. That is, a man could have as many wives as he could afford, just like he could have as many cattle as he could afford. And if you look at the creation story in the book of Genesis, the only ethic is in the Cain and Abel, in the Adam and Eve story, the only ethic is that the man was to treat the woman with kindness, not that she was to be a partner or equal. She was to be a helpmate. Those are cultural patterns, and we, you know, you have to break cultural patterns, and that happens all the time. That's just the nature of the beast. Look at the revolutions we've had in knowledge since the time the Bible was written. The Bible assumed that epilepsy and mental illness were caused by demon possession. The Bible assumed that it was okay to have slavery. And, you know, many passages, even Paul writes about how you ought to treat your slaves. He was in favor of a kind and gentle slavery. Never occurred to him to be opposed to the institution itself. The attitude toward women was the same toward homosexuals. Even Paul says that homosexuality is a punishment from God for not worshiping God properly. That's a really strange idea. But Paul was a first century man, and he was reflecting the level of knowledge he had in the first century. The Bible assumes that the earth is the center of a three-tiered universe. We haven't believed that since Copernicus, at least as an intellectual community, we haven't believed that. It's taken people a long time to catch up with that. The concept of evolving through 4.5 billion years of life on this planet Earth is a very different concept from what you see in the biblical story. So what you have to do is you have to get beneath the biblical explanation and try to touch the biblical experience, and then try to find a way to translate the biblical experience into the language and the concepts of the 21st century. And that's a task that goes on every century in the Christian church. And we have a tendency in organized religion to freeze what we believe is truth, as if we could capture it in human words. Mm-hmm. We think that way about the Bible. We say if the Bible is the inerrant word of God, well, that's just absolute absurd. If you read the Bible, you certainly don't want to blame God for some of the stuff in the Bible. And we say that the creeds were hammered out under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. Well, the Holy Spirit didn't seem to know in the 4th century that the earth was not the center of a three-tiered universe, because the creeds have a three-tiered escalator in the creeds, where God comes down and descends and ascends and rises. But, you know, you can't ever freeze language. It doesn't work that way. And that's part of the task of the Christian church. What we have going on in organized Christianity today is that the louder voices have frozen Christianity in some sort of fundamentalistic pattern, so that they're opposed to anything that's modern. They're opposed to evolution. They're opposed to a new way of viewing homosexuality. They're even opposed deep down to treating women as equal. And you know, we've got to do something about that. The alternative is that people say, well, if that's what Christianity is, I don't want any part of it. And so the alternative to fundamentalism is a rapidly growing secular society where Christianity is simply dismissed as a sort of pre-modern bit of ignorance. Mm-hmm. And I think we can do a lot better than that. I think we can penetrate into the core of the story and try to touch the experience and then find a way to talk about it. The best way to illustrate that, I think, is with the Jesus figure, and that's why Jesus for the non-religious was the focus. What they experienced in Jesus in some way was that they found something transcendent in their experience with him, and they didn't know how to translate that. Their idea of God was that God was a supernatural being who lived above the sky. So they began to tell stories about how that supernatural being had come into this world in a human form, because that's the only categories they had. Now, if you dismiss their explanation, do you have to dismiss their experience? I think that's the clue. And what I wanted to do is take the experience that somehow, in some way, God was present. Whatever God is, God was present for these people in the life of Jesus of Nazareth, and to try to understand what there was about his life that caused them to assert that rather phenomenal claim for him.
Mm-hmm. I was deeply moved years ago when I first read the book Cost of Discipleship.
Yes, by
the
great
German pastor, theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I didn't realize that he was the first to coin the phrase religionless Christianity.
It's the first I know of. Now, maybe you know, I can't ever be sure that somebody's phrase is the first. It's the first place I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Bonhoeffer also also paid the price. You know, the cost of discipleship was something he paid. He was hanged by the Nazis in April of 1945. 2 weeks before the Allied armies freed his prison camp at Flossenbürg. And, you know, unfortunately, one of the great fertile theological minds of the 20th century died at that point. But Bonhoeffer, in his letters and papers from prison, which were saved by his friend Eberhard Bethge and published under that title after the war, kept contemplating what would it look like if we separate Christianity from religion. And I think that's really something that we need to do today, because I think religion, as we understand it, is a dying phenomenon. I don't think Christianity necessarily is, but most people can't make that separation.
Bishop Spong, there does seem to be a growing movement toward an inclusive faith. I guess you could often call it a new Christianity.
Yes, I think there is. I think it's still a minority, but I believe it's growing. When I was teaching at Harvard in the year 2000, after I retired, I did some lectures that I entitled A New Christianity for a New World, where I tried to articulate what the aspects of that new Christianity might look like. And yes, I find it there. Inside the Christian faith, there is as well as the negative prejudice aspect of fundamentalism, there is this frontier breaking of people who are looking for new images. I found it interesting that among the most effective lobbyists in the New York legislative battle over the equal rights, equal marriage law was a group of Christian clergy. Hmm. And they were walking through the halls of the assembly in their clerical collars and black shirts, and they were of all denominations. There is a part of the Episcopal Church, the United Church of Christ, the Presbyterian Church, the Methodist Church, that understands that prejudice or anything that diminishes the full humanity of any other child of God is simply evil. And so that's why the Christian church is in such interesting turmoil and split. In my church, we had 3 or 4 or 5 bishops that preferred to leave the Episcopal Church rather than to be part of a community that began to treat gay and lesbian people as if they were completely human and children of God.
Hmm. It seems like there's such a need for less fear and more faith these days. What's the basis of your faith?
Goodness, Richard, you ask interesting and profound questions. I don't know how to respond to that. I have always had this incredible sense of the reality of God. It's been a God that I haven't always been able to define, but I've always had this experience. And, you know, I've gone through the ranks of everything. I grew up a Southern fundamentalist in the Episcopal Church, but still very much a fundamentalist. And I became, later on, when that began to crack up, and I was maybe 15 or 16 when I knew too much from just going to high school to make fundamentalism viable for me any longer. But I wouldn't, you know, usually when that happens, people give up their religion. All I did was keep trying to find a new form of it. And the first thing I did was to substitute a kind of ecclesiastical fundamentalism for biblical fundamentalism. I started saying that the church teaches instead of the Bible says. Mm-hmm. And then that cracked open after about 4 or 5 more years. And I became whatever it is I am now. I'm absolutely convinced of the reality of God. I'm also convinced that there are no human words that will ever capture that reality. And so the Christian life for me is to walk into the mystery and wonder of God. And I don't know what the road signs are. And mm-hmm. I don't even know what the end product will be. But I think the journey is worth taking. And so I continue to be on this journey. And I've been fortunate enough to write enough books to have a following out there. And I know that I speak for a lot of people. I know that I also irritate a lot of people. And most particularly, the people I irritate are those who have put their confidence in a particular answer. I don't believe there is a particular answer. And I think the job of the Christian faith is not to give you the answers or even to give you peace of mind. I think the job of the Christian faith is to give you the courage to accept the ambiguities of life and to walk with faith into the mystery of God without worrying about whether you've got the answers or not.
You just mentioned about people looking for specific answers. My question is, what seems to be the attraction for many people to fundamentalism, and not just in Christianity, but in all religions?
That's right. It's a personality type more than it is a religious content. I think the very nature of human life is to be insecure. And most people have a difficult time living with the ambiguities and the insecurities of human life, and so they're always looking for answers. That's why the Pope has to be infallible. That's why the Bible has to be inerrant. That's why every religion claims it is the only true religion and that it controls the access to God. That's in the nature of our humanity. It's also quite demonic, because it's in the name of the true religion that we do terrible things to one another. This is where religious persecution comes from. This is where religious wars come from. This is where we burn heretics at the stake. This is where religious intolerance comes from. We really need to recognize that the reality of God cannot be embraced in any human formula. I don't care whether it's a Christian formula, a Muslim formula, or a Buddhist formula, or a Jewish formula. There is no human form that can embrace the wonder and mystery of God. I am a Christian because I walk into the mystery of God through the Christ path. But I don't think that I've got the answers. And if I walk deep enough, I think I escape the boundaries of Christianity, because I don't think God's a Christian. You know, that's again, a silly sort of thing. I don't think God's a Muslim or a Jew either. I think God is beyond all human religions, and I honor human religions. But I don't idolize them. I am a Christian because I walk through the Christian understanding in order to reach the mystery of God. But if I walk far enough and deep enough, I will have to transcend the limits of Christianity. And a lot of people, I think, want security and answers. And so there's, I think there'll always be fundamentalism. The thing that, I'm not even concerned about that. The thing that I'm concerned about is to offer the people who can't be fundamentalist a different way into the worship experience, and in my perspective, into the Christian experience. And I find when you're able to do that, there is this enormous response, because I think people are just innately religious. If you can find a way that they can enter a religious experience without violating their minds, or, as I've suggested, turning their brains into 21st century pretzels in order to believe the formulas of the first century Bible or the fourth century creeds or the 13th century's primary liturgy forms. And I don't believe that's the thing we need to be doing. But I think there is a deep hunger. I think St. Augustine was correct when he said, "Thou hast made us for thyself alone, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee." But what happens in organized religion is that we put formulas and words and say, this is who God is and this is what God means. And when people get to the place that they can no longer use those words, they say, well, if that's what God means, I don't believe there is a God. So the real battle is between those who claim too much for religion and those who say religion has nothing to offer me, because the only kind of religion they know is the kind that claims too much. Richard Dawkins, whom I know fairly well, is a wonderful example of that. And when I read Richard Dawkins's books, and he's a charming man, I must say, when I read his books, I don't find myself in disagreement with his analysis of religion and of Christianity. What I find myself in disagreement with is that that's what he thinks Christianity is, and he doesn't seem to know anything else. And I'd like to offer him another possibility, and maybe someday I'll have that opportunity.
Bishop, you wrote that Christianity is not a call to be religious, but a call to be human.
That is correct, and that's overwhelmingly the message of Jesus in the New Testament. When you look at the Jesus story, what he does over and over and over again is to call people beyond the barriers that feed our human insecurities. He calls us beyond the tribal boundary. That's why Paul can say in Christ is neither Jew nor Greek. He calls us beyond the male-female boundary. Jesus had female disciples. I don't know how the church missed that. They're in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and they don't become visible in the Jesus story until all the male disciples have forsaken him and fled, and then the women become visible. But then all three of those evangelists say that these women, by the way, have followed Jesus all the way from Galilee. That is, they've always been part of the Jesus movement. And they had a leader, and her name was Magdalene, and the church has done a really terrible thing to Magdalene. They've turned her into a prostitute. There's not a shred of evidence in the Bible that she was a prostitute. But the church didn't like women, not real live women. They like mythological women, like spotless, pure virgin mothers. They could tolerate that, but they couldn't tolerate a real woman, particularly a real woman who was associated with Jesus. And yet, if you read the Gospels closely, you'll find that Mary Magdalene is at Jesus' side in his life and is the primary mourner at his tomb in his death, and is clearly a significant part of the Jesus movement. And so in order to get rid of the threat of a real live woman, we turned her into a prostitute. And they did that. It's quite clear. I can go back and show you where that came into Christian history. And they did it by identifying Mary Magdalene with the woman of the street who washed Jesus' feet. Now, that's just there's no relationship between those two at all. And they identify Mary Magdalene with the woman taken in the act of adultery, which is a free-floating story that winds up in the 8th chapter of John, but the early John manuscripts don't include it. And then you go back far enough, and it's a Luke story. It sort of seems to float freely. But we just did a number because basically we treated women as something fearful. You know, when the Christian church says in order to be a holy man, you cannot be related to a woman, you have to be a celibate male, what they're saying is that women are somehow corruptors of holy men. I don't believe that for a moment. If I've got any chance to be holy, it's because I live inside the incredible love of my wife, Christine. There's nothing sinful about that. But you see, what happened in Christian history was that as we moved out of a Jewish world into a Greek world, we moved into philosophical dualism, where the body was considered evil and the soul was considered good, where earth was evil and heaven was good, where flesh was evil and spirit was good. And then we began to tell the Christian story in terms of you got to deny the flesh. And so you get by the end of it happened in the 12th century, early 12th century, where they mandated celibacy for clergy, although that was the tradition, the majority tradition from about the 3rd century on. It wasn't the original tradition. Indeed, the Roman Church claims that Peter was the first pope, and one of the stories that's told in the early chapters of Mark's Gospel is that Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law. Well, normally, if you have a mother-in-law, you've got a wife. Someone said, if you have a mother-in-law without a wife, that really is cruel and unusual punishment. But, you know, it's pretty overt, pretty obvious. And even Paul argues that the other disciples can travel with their wives and talks about why he decides not to. So the celibacy was a late development in the Christian church, and it came because we had bought a dualistic point of view and we considered the flesh evil. And therefore, you have to get rid of any real live woman who might be part of the Jesus movement. You know, then you watch what happens to the virgin. The virgin is not nearly as important a person in the gospel tradition as Mary Magdalene. Her name is mentioned only one time in the first gospel, and that's Mark. And somebody from the crowd, this is in Mark chapter 6, somebody in the crowd says, "Now where does Jesus get all this stuff? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary?" That's the only time the word Mary is used in the whole first gospel. The first gospel wasn't written until the early years of the 8th decade. So it's already 40 years after the time of Jesus. And then she's portrayed in Mark's gospel as thinking Jesus is out of his mind. If you read Mark 3 and Mark 6, Mary and Jesus' brothers and their name, four of them, and sisters, they're not named, but they're at least two of them because it's a plural word, go to take Jesus away because he's become sort of a family embarrassment. She's not portrayed as a very effective person. She does not appear at the cross until the fourth gospel is written, and that's the late years of the 10th decade. That's somewhere between 95 and 100. Mary is not at the cross in Mark or Matthew or Luke. She only appears there in the fourth gospel, written between 95 and 100. So that she's not a very significant character, but the feminine has got to be part of the story because it's a part of life. And so they begin to put the feminine in, and they can't deal with Mary Magdalene, so they trash her. And then they start this process, and this is in church history, it's not in the Bible, where Mary becomes not just a virgin mother, she becomes a virgin mother only in Matthew and Luke, and that's the 9th decade. And then she becomes a perpetual virgin mother, and that's when the brothers that are mentioned by name in Mark have to be called either half-brothers or cousins. And then she becomes a postpartum virgin about the 3rd century, and then she becomes immaculately conceived in the 19th century, and then she becomes bodily assumed in the 20th century. So that what we did was to take the ideal woman, or the woman we defined as the ideal woman, and we de-sexed her, and then we dehumanized her, and then we said it's okay for her to ascend into the presence of God. I think that says a lot about what we think about women. And I don't happen to think women are somehow sinful or evil or fleshly. I think women are part of the wonderful created order, and I think the human life is deeply affirmed in the fullness of its humanity and the primary love between a man and a woman. And so I celebrate that. So I don't find myself in particular sympathy with some of the ways in which sexuality has been treated in human history.
One of my favorite lines from one of your books, I still remember it, and you wrote, "Jesus came to earth to teach three things: risking for love, daring to live, and having the courage to be who you are."
Yep.
I think you've called that your trinity.
That's right. to love, to live fully, to love wastefully, and to be all that you can be. You see, I believe God is the source of life, and so I worship God by living fully. I believe God is the source of love, so I worship God by loving wastefully. I believe God is the ground of being, a phrase I get from Paul Tillich, who was my primary teacher and theologian, but he got it from Plotinus, so nobody does anything original. And that's to call God the ground of being, and if God's the ground of being, you worship God by having the courage to be all that you can be. Now, if that's who God is, then what do we mean when we say that we find Jesus, God present in Jesus? I think it's because we see his life fully lived, we see his love wastefully given. You know, there's nobody that's outside the love of Jesus. Even those that kill him are the beneficiaries of his love. And I see him being all that he can be, even when he's being killed. The portrait of Jesus on the cross is a pretty powerful portrait. Here this man is being put to death unjustly, and he's spending his time, according to the biblical portrait, loving those who are killing him, praying for their forgiveness, being concerned about their own needs. That's a powerful portrait of life that is not survival-oriented. I think most human life, indeed most life, is survival-oriented. I think I see in Jesus a transcendence of that survival-oriented life so that he's free to give his life and his love away, and that's to me the nature of God. And if you give it away, then you got to accept people like they are. And I don't see any way you can get around that. I look at the church, and I wonder how we could possibly have supported slavery and segregation. And I did that. You know, I did that. I grew up in that kind of world. I didn't even know how segregated my world was. It was just a way of life. I don't see how you can be the Christian church and say that women are not fully human and fully equal. And so the debate about whether women should be ordained is a nonsensical debate for me. And because I'm absolutely convinced that homosexuality is not something people choose, but something to which people awaken, and all medical and scientific data supports that point of view, then for us to diminish gay and lesbian people because they aren't normal, because we've defined the norm as heterosexual, well, we also defined right-handed people as normal, and we used to persecute left-handed children up until the early years of the 20th century. Because we have an ignorant definition of what it means to be human, we have perpetuated inhumane practices upon an awful lot of God's people in this world because they're black or because they're female or because they're homosexual or whatever else, left-handed. Mm-hmm. We've done it mentally ill. You know, the church wouldn't even bury a person who committed suicide until relatively late in the 20th century. Because they didn't know that mental illness was mental illness, and so it was an abnormality and it was a sin. That's really strange behavior, and I'm glad we sort of escaped that.
We're talking about not only his latest book, Jesus for the Non-Religious, but also his take and observation on various things that are developing around this world. Bishop Spong, over the last decade or so, there has been this amazing convergence of science and spirituality. Do you see that as a key component in helping to create a new humanity that you've talked about?
Yes, I think it is. But again, I think it sets up some problems. I have a friend who talks about the need to be spiritual but not religious, and I find that's a phrase that rings true with a lot of people. Religion is a set of rules. It has become a set of rules. It's become a creed that you have to sort of buy into instead of an open-ended search for God. But I find that when you get particularly into the world of physics and astronomy and astrophysics, that the mystery and wonder of the universe is so overwhelming, but it doesn't necessarily affirm the creedal statements of the Christian faith. And so people are looking for a way to talk about God, to talk about the spiritual side of life outside the boundaries of organized religion, so that Bonhoeffer's phrase, to go back to him for a moment, of religionless Christianity, or seeing God beyond the boundaries of religion, becomes, I think, a major sort of text for what I think we need to do in the 21st century. And that's been going on for a long time. The Bible is written from the point of view of God as an external supernatural being above the sky. And a lot of the Bible doesn't make much sense if you don't believe that. I mean, in the book of Genesis, they talk about building a tower, the Tower of Babel, that will be so tall it will get to heaven, and you can climb up the tower and you can speak to God. Well, that makes no sense if God's not living above the sky. And the ascension of Jesus makes no sense. The story of Jesus rising up into the sky, in our world, in our frame of reference, we know that if he rises up far enough and fast enough, he doesn't get to heaven, he gets into orbit. And if he doesn't get into orbit, he just sinks into the infinity of space. Carl Sagan said to me on one occasion that if Jesus literally rose from this earth into the sky, and if he traveled at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, he hadn't yet gotten out of our galaxy. Because we now know so much more about the dimensions of our universe. Indeed, I was listening to a professor at Cal Berkeley this morning lecturing on astrophysics, and he's talking about the fact that our universe might not be the only universe. There might be many universes in this world. Well, that's almost beyond the capacity of the mind to embrace. But when the Bible was written, the Earth was thought to be the center of the universe. The sun rotated around the Earth. That was obvious. You saw it rise in the morning. You saw it set in the evening. And when Copernicus and Galileo first came out and proposed some other possibility, Copernicus died before his work was published, so he didn't have to pay much of a price. But Galileo was put on trial for his life, and he was found guilty. And he did a plea bargain where he had admitted, I'm sure with his fingers crossed, that he didn't really believe what he had written, but he accepted house arrest for the balance of his life, and he promised never to write again. And it wasn't until 1991 that the Vatican finally issued a paper in which they said, we now believe Galileo was right. But in the meantime, we've developed space travel. So Galileo had to be right. You know, it's 50 years after space travel had begun, the Vatican begins to say, well, maybe Galileo was right. That's how out of touch we are with reality. And then, of course, we spend an awful lot of energy fighting Darwin today, and there's creation science, and there's intelligent design, and We have textbook battles all over the country because people want to teach something that's not science in science classrooms. They want to suggest that evolution is just a theory like all other theories and ought to be balanced with creation theories. Well, that's just pitiful to me. I don't want my children to grow up ignorant of the world in which they live, and I certainly don't want them to grow up ignorant because they think that in order to save religion, they've got to stay ignorant. What a strange God it would be that we have to protect God from knowledge, lest if people learn some things that they will no longer believe in God, at least the God that we have proposed to them. So we've got some interesting problems going on in our world, and I'd like to suggest that there's a better way to deal with them than to enter into the science-religion battle, which we've been doing since Galileo.
Mm-hmm. Politics is also making the headlines these days, and in light of the current debate on whether to raise our nation's debt ceiling, there seems to be a fine line between encouraging the entrepreneurial spirit and caring for the least of these, our brothers and sisters, and I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on walking that fine line?
It is a fine line, and there are two things that you need to affirm. One is that this nation has been, I don't know what word to use, but we've clearly lived beyond our means, and so has Europe, and so has Greece, and so has Italy, and so has Portugal. And there comes a time when the debt catches up. And then people say, well, we've got to do something about this. And the way they want to do something about it is to cut the kind of social welfare benefits. They want to cut Medicare, they want to cut Social Security. And this country, you know, you have to live out your values. I hope that we can get this problem solved at some point, but I find the rhetoric going on in Washington today is just almost childlike to listen to these people battling, and sometime there'll have to be a compromise, and it will... I don't know any economist that thinks we'll ever get out of a financial problem if we don't both raise revenues and cut spending. And that's where the battle line is. One party doesn't want to cut anything, and the other party doesn't want to raise revenues. Well, that's a good prescription for disaster. And if this country wants to go the way of Greece, they can keep walking this path. But when you begin to cut spending, I think it's those of us who have more of this world's goods are going to find that we have to give more to support the minimum decency that I think we would want the citizens of this country to enjoy. I think everybody's got a basic right to enough food to eat and to have proper medical care and to live in housing that's decent. And I don't see any way around that. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, this country, if it keeps going the way it's been going for the last 20, 30 years, the gap between the rich and the poor will become so large that I think it sets in motion the possibility of a revolution in which the rich will lose a good bit more than they would lose if they would admit to the possibility of paying a higher rate of tax for the benefit of the whole. But if you do that, the government has also got a responsibility to use that money wisely. And, you know, we do build bridges to nowhere, and we do enter into wars that aren't even in our national interest, but they're in the interest of the military-industrial complex. And I think we've got to confront all of those issues before we're going to solve this problem.
Mm. Years ago, there was a wristband that came out, WWJD. Yeah. What would Jesus do? And I'm wondering, through your unique lens of how you see Jesus, what would Jesus do about another issue that is very, very important, and that's immigration? Are we our brother's keeper?
Well, it really is interesting. This nation is a nation of immigrants. Even the Native Americans are immigrants from Siberia. There are no natural primates that developed in the Western Hemisphere. So, you know, we first start out. Now, when do you get to the place where those of us who are all immigrants can close immigration to someone else? But underneath the immigration problem there are two problems. One is massive overpopulation. And we have, somewhere between 6 and 7 billion people in the world today, and we've been going up rapidly, that we will reach the point where the resources of this world will not support the constant breeding of human life. And yet everything about our society, business, church, everything is based upon a continuing rise in the population, so we'll have more people to buy our products and use the resources that we are developing and offering. So that you got to address that problem, and that's going to be a huge problem. We were in China just last summer, I guess it was, and China has addressed the overpopulation problem, but they've done it in a way that I don't believe that those of us in the Western world with a different set of values would want. You know, they've mandated one child per family, and they've mandated it at the point where they forced abortions upon people if they were pregnant the second time, and they've caused an awful lot of people who have a girl to have that child either put up for adoption or accidentally killed so they can try again to have a son, because China values men more than women. And today in China, the birth rate is 120 males to 100 females. If you want to build an unstable society, you let that nation of over about 1.3 billion people, if the ratio is 120 males to 100 females, you're going to have a real revolution at some point in the history of that nation. In the United States, if you go back to the Clinton administration, in those 8 years, the difference between the wealthy and the poor grew exponentially. And it was the fastest growing decade in American history of capital. We created more capital in America in the 1990s than in our entire history up until the 1990s. And then when George Bush became the president succeeding Bill Clinton, he tripled and even quadrupled the gap between the rich and the poor. It started with Clinton. It's nonpartisan. It started with Clinton, but it just went off the charts. And if you don't begin to bring the resources of this incredible wealth that we have produced, if you don't bring a chunk of that wealth back to invest in the body politic of the whole people, in education, in health care, in quality of life, then you're going to reach the place that Karl Marx anticipated, that capitalism would wind up with very few people, like 1% of the people owning all the means of production and all of the capital. And then what you get is a revolution. You have a very unstable world. People will do a lot of things before they'll starve to death, and including have a revolution. So I think it's just in the nature of good sense that we work toward a society. I don't want to kill the entrepreneurial spirit. I think that capitalism still is, I don't know of any other system that's produced as many benefits for as many people, but it's got a downside. And it needs to be tempered with social legislation, and that costs money, and that comes from taxes. So I think we've got to find a way that we take the capital that we've created and invest it for the well-being of the whole. And you can't just do this today in the United States, because it's a world problem.
Right.
And that's happening. Back in the old days when I lived in the South, northern industries would close up in the North and move their plants into the South, because there was no labor unions down there. There was a lot of labor, and it was relatively cheap, and they could save money. And then I lived to watch them take it from the South and go down to Mexico or Dominican Republic or Haiti, and then they go to China and they go to India. What's happening is there's a leveling of the benefits to the people of the world going on in the world today. And that means the standard of living of the very wealthy is going to go down. It means the standard of living of the very poor is going to go up. And if it doesn't, you're going to always have huge immigration problems. I was fascinated to read a story in the New York Times recently that said that the immigration pressure from Mexico was lessening, because Mexico is now developing economically with industries that provide jobs for its people. And so the people would prefer to stay in Mexico if they could make a decent living. And so the pressure has gone down, and I think that's the secret. If you want to stop immigration, you help the world develop so that a quality of life can be provided for all people in every nation. And as long as we've got Haiti with its poverty level, and the Dominican Republic, and heretofore Mexico, you're going to have pressure on the borders of this country. It's interesting to me that we don't want to build a fence across the border between Canada and the United States, only between Mexico and the United States. And there's a bit of racism in that, too.
One of my favorite quotes is said to be from Chief Sitting Bull, and it goes, "Come, let us put our minds together to see what kind of lives we can create for our children." You and your wife, Christine, have 5 children and 6 grandchildren. We've been witnessing an increased lack of civility, especially in politics. How can we have open, honest, and healthy dialogue and put our minds together for the sake of our children?
I think that's a real good question. I don't think I've ever seen the political discourse get to the place where I think it is in America today. I think part of that is racism. I still think there are some people who can't quite embrace the fact that this country has an African-American president, and so they want to get at him in any way they can. But I think it's deeper than that. We are in a tough economic time. In America, a lot of people are out of work. The official rate's 9.2% today, but I suspect that if you look at that more closely, it's considerably higher than that. It wouldn't surprise me if it's at 15 or 16%, because people stop looking after a while, and so they fall off the charts. And also, it affects racial minorities more than it affects people who are in the dominant majority race, and it affects inner-city people. And I lived in Newark. It would not be surprising to see 25% unemployment rate of black males under 30 years of age. That's just a prescription for disaster. So I think you've got to address the social problems that we have. And when people lose their jobs in America, they also lose their health care. And then they lose their houses. There's an enormous amount of anger in America today because of the economic downturn. And then, of course, when both Bush and Obama, when they began to address the economic downturn, did it with rescuing the banks. You know, the banks in some way were the people, and they said they had to do that because if the banks went under, the whole world's economy would go under, and I'm not enough of an economist to make a debate on that point. But for people who are suffering to see that the primary beneficiary of government largesse are the great financial institutions of the world, whom we liquefied so that they could meet their obligations and didn't go into bankruptcy, that has also created anger. And it's interesting to watch where the anger is directed in this country. The Tea Party movement seems to direct the anger against the government. I think the anger ought to be addressed to the greed among the wealthy people in this country who run the great financial institutions. But that's not where the anger is right now. Mm-hmm. So we're having this incredibly difficult public discourse, and people are hardly civil. And I was really delighted to see that Boehner and Obama played golf together a few weeks ago. That at least looked like they weren't going to cut off each other's heads in the process. But the discourse is fearful. And I think that bodes poorly for America. I don't see any reason why we can't work out a negotiated settlement that would get the majority of the Republicans and the majority of the Democrats to agree on raising the budget, the debt ceiling, and lowering the cost and raising sufficient revenues to put this country into a proper economic frame of reference. I think people forget the reason we're in such a budgetary crisis is we had 2 wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, that were never funded through the budget. We just ran up a huge deficit. And then in Mr. Bush's administration, we had 2 tax cuts. The first one, almost every economist in the world thought was justified because there was an increasing surplus. The second was so badly weighted toward wealthy people and away from poor people. And that's the one that they just extended last year before we got into this present crisis. Those tax breaks were not accompanied by spending cuts. And you can't have it both ways. So we've got 2 wars and a second tax cut in this country that did not produce the revenue or expand the economy, and so we've been building this incredible deficit. But we've been building this deficit for a right long time. We've got to address it, and that means belt tightening. Mm-hmm. And if we don't want to become the next Greece or the next Italy or the next Spain or the next Portugal, and I don't mean that's going to happen next week or next month, but I think if we don't address the economic realities of this country, that could happen within a decade. And I think it'll be disastrous for everybody, and politicians on both sides of the aisle will rue the day they didn't address the issues that are facing us right now.
And given that situation that you just described, and in the last minute or two we have left of our time, What words of hope can you give to our listeners who probably are experiencing a healthy level of anxiety and fear? What would Jesus say to them?
Well, I always want to be hesitant that I speak for Jesus, but I would say that as I read the Gospels, and particularly the fourth Gospel, I find the message of Jesus to be that I've come that you might have life and have it abundantly. Now, how do you give abundant life to people? How do you keep them creative and yet build a floor under them so that nobody can fall into an inhumane kind of life? That's what we need to do both for our nation and ultimately for our world. I don't believe that you can diminish any human being and still say you worship God. And I think that's biblical. It's the first epistle of St. John that says, how can a person say, I love God whom you haven't seen, if you're not able to love your neighbor whom you have seen? Now, what is love? I don't think love means meeting everybody's needs, but I think love does mean respecting everybody and giving everybody equal opportunity, which may be as deep a gift as we can give. The Republican governor of New Jersey some years ago, Tom Kane, who was an incredibly gifted man, I thought. But Tom Kane used to say, the job of government is to make the playing field level. Mm. You know, you can't give people incentive, but you can make the playing field level. And then people have to play, but at least it starts out as a fair game. There will be winners and there will be losers in the fair game. But you want to build a society where the losers don't lose their humanity and where the winners don't become so arrogant that they don't think they've got a responsibility for the rest of the people who helped to make them what they are.
Bishop John Shelby Spong, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Richard, it's wonderful to be with you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. If you'd like to learn more about the life and work of Bishop Spong, his web address is johnshelbyspong.com. In closing, I'd like to share the words of Bishop Spong, taken from his epilogue in the book Jesus for the Non-Religious. He writes, long ago, in the year 1974, I preached a sermon in St. Paul's Church, Richmond, Virginia, that later I recognized was a breakthrough in my own consciousness. St. Paul's was located in the heart of that old and great city that had once served as the capital of the Confederacy. Both Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis worshipped regularly in that church during the dark days of the American Civil War. I was, even then, seeking to find a new way to understand this Jesus, who so clearly the central symbol in my faith tradition, but with images I wrestled with constantly. My inner conflict and the tension it produced was familiar. I was drawn at that time, as I still am, to the person of Jesus in powerful and compelling ways. I was also bothered and repelled by the distorting myths that surrounded him, and stifled by the controlling religion that appeared to have captured him. The shelf life of a sermon is brief indeed. Most do not linger in people's mind beyond the day they were heard, if it makes it that long. A gifted poet in Richmond, however, named Lucy Newton Bogswell Negus, took that particular sermon and laid out its core message in free verse. She entitled it Christ Power. In the writing of this book, that poem has always been before me. I therefore conclude this study of Jesus with the words that I articulated then and that Lucy Negus shaped in that now distant year of 1974. I do so because not only are the seeds that ultimately produced this book located in that poem, but in many ways it has been the focus of my study for over 30 years. The poem goes, look at him. Look not at his divinity, but rather at his freedom. Look not at the exaggerated tales of his power, but look rather at his infinite capacity to give himself away. Look not at the first century mythology that surrounds him, but look rather at his courage to be, his ability to live, and the contagious quality of his love. Stop your frantic search. Be still. And know that this is God, this love, this freedom, this life, this being. And when you're accepted, accept yourself. When you're forgiven, forgive yourself. When you're loved, love yourself. Grasp that Christ power and dare to be yourself. And Spong says, "This is, I believe, the pathway to God, the God whom I have encountered in the profoundly human Jesus." Shalom. Hey, that's today's program. Once again, thank you so much for joining me. Website, as you know, is richardbrendan.com. Encourage all your friends to tune into iTunes each week. I want to thank my engineer, Thomas Gismondi, and I want to thank production coordinator, Angel Richardson, for helping to make this possible. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Dying to Live.